Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
My Life as an Animal, Serialization, Week 4. This episode is brought to you by animalaid.org.uk, who campaign peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promote cruelty-free living.
It's now time to continue our audiobook here on UK Health Radio, My Life as an Animal, written by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith.
My Life as an Animal. A joyous description of those early to mid-70s NME days was offered by Ian in a March 2001 interview he gave to an admiring young rock writer. "I'd just come down from Cambridge, so I was used to a more elevated style of banter. To be honest, when I first walked into NME, it seemed like a loony kindergarten. Everyone was mucking around and laughing and sprawling on each other's desks like delinquent kids. It took me about 10 minutes to adjust. After that, I became one of the silliest members of the team. Being on that paper was a riot, and we never stopped. Come lunchtime, we'd straggle off through the West End to find some lunch, preferably somewhere with a jukebox so we could keep the soundtrack going. Early in the evening, we'd reluctantly knock off and collect in the pub next door. Then it was all back to Tony Tyler's place in Highbury, or Charlie's Eyrie in Islington, or Mickey Farron's flat in Notting Hill, or the shabby communal house Andrew, Kent and I shared in Maida Vale. In the early hours, we'd crash, then reassemble in the office next morning to take up where we'd left off. And we carry on through the weekends, one long party. You'd think we'd got sick of the sight of each other, but we even had a postmodern office outing to Margate. The entire crew, about 30 of us, whirling stonily around on dodgems in silly hats, howling with laughter, and then back to town for yet another evening party. It was a complete world of its own. I can't imagine anyone who was there not looking back on that time with great fondness and nostalgia. I've known nothing remotely like it since. The Tony Tyler Ian refers to was the mirthful, inventive, intellectually provocative and exceptionally tall NME features editor. Being loud and forceful as well as tall, we called him, from time to time, the Towering Inferno. It was Tony who talent-spotted Chrissy Hynde and got her on board. He did the same for me. More revealingly, there would have been no Human Pyramids or Enter Mr. Kent during the strike period, if not for Tony Tyler. Whenever we got together to act the fool, sing and play songs, argue, laugh and consume psychoactive substances, we knew we'd have a better time if Tony was there. He had the same effect on the NME itself. He embodied so much of its mischief and ambition. Of the musicians I spent time with, the one who exuded the most joy, the most intense love of his art, was Stevie Wonder. I have a large picture of the two of us on my office wall, a few feet from where I'm typing. Stevie had grabbed my little tape recorder and is interviewing me using his Dick Van Dyke Cockney voice. I've got a big dopey smile on my face. It was January 1974, and he was in London for a series of Rainbow Theatre concerts. As with Clapton's Rainbow appearance 12 months before, Stevie was also feeling his way back to performance fitness. In his case, following an August 1973 car crash in which he took an almighty clout on the forehead that bruised his brain and left him in a coma for nearly 3 days. I don't know how the record label carved up Stevie's offstage time between competing journalists, but I was happy when told I could join him for the drive from the airport to his little Bijou West End hotel. He was quiet during the journey, And I wasn't able to pin him down with a volley of "What's it like to be in London? Does your head hurt?" type questions. His spirits had lifted by the time we got to the hotel, and he quickly made for a piano in a downstairs lounge. It is the memory of that 10-minute performance, played before a handful of awestruck hotel guests, that I cherish above any other from his 1974 visit. Maybe he does too. After lunch, with my tape recorder aimed back at me, he wanted to know what I thought of Marvin Gaye. "Another great talent," I said, whose musical development was in some way running parallel to his own. He rolled the word "parallel" around his palate, and what criticism would I make of his music? He pushed me on that until finally I said, "On some of your numbers, you should think about giving more wallop to the drum track." He was just 23 years old. I first heard him as the 12-year-old falsetto Little Stevie Wonder on his June 1962 live recording of Fingertips, Part 1 and 2. They played it in a couple of the West End blues clubs I'd go to as a 17 and 18-year-old. The performances, which also featured his prodigious harmonica playing, were taped at the Regal Theatre, Chicago, during a Motown review. Already hailed as a genius, Stevie's Fingertips went on to top the US Billboard chart. The drummer on the track was Marvin Gaye. The Rainbow Concerts showcased his considerable talents, but it seemed he was being buffeted by emotions he couldn't control. Maybe they were car crash related. Searching for the right gesture, he suddenly yanked off his dark glasses and flung them in the direction of the Rainbow crowd. In thanking me for the Stevie piece, one of the London record company's PRs was particularly pleased with my description of an over-keen colleague had been touching and buzzing around Stevie like a fading autumn wasp. "He does that to all the artists," she told me. "It's embarrassing." The Beatles probably received more irrational worship than any act in memory. Yet, like Stevie, I don't believe they traded on their fame in an obvious way, the don't-you-know-who-I-am syndrome. I was interviewing Ringo in 1971 in the offices of their Apple record company when George walked in, greeted Ringo, and reached for a book on a high shelf. "This is Andrew from Disc," Ringo said to George. And to me, he said, "This is George, George Harrison." He might have added, "one of the famous Liverpool Beatle band." John Lennon was the same. We met at the record plant in New York, where he was recording the Mind Games album. I just returned to the studio from a nearby restaurant and an interview with his then much detested wife, Yoko. I think John liked the idea of a journalist coming to have a conversation with his wife rather than scoff at her. He invited me to listen in to the mixing of one of the album tracks, Intuition. The session went on for 3 hours. Every 30 minutes or so, he came to the listening booth for some inconsequential chatter. Our subjects included leaky high street cinemas, bagged tea versus loose tea, and favourite English biscuits. He was hungry for conversation that made zero intellectual demands. "A lot of people, when they first met him," he said, "fawned and slobbered at the feet of the great Beatle. Others, anxious to show they were not famestruck, went at him aggressively." He paused and suddenly asked, "Do I know you from somewhere?" I shook my head. "We haven't met." He asked again. I gave him another no. He continued to look at me searchingly. "I would have remembered," I said, with an unanswerable logic. On the way out of the studio, he saw the actress, Julie Christie. "Hello, Julie Christie," he called to her, studying her jeans, floppy t-shirt and the casual cut of her hair. "You've changed a bit since Leeds." He offered me a ride back to my hotel, which we reached within 5 minutes. His chauffeur drew up outside. Lennon still looked relaxed, and so I asked, "Where are you off to now?" hoping he'd respond, "Oh, nowhere much. Why don't you come along?" Instead, he studied me with what I read as cold suspicion. It turned out to be more than a private keep-out sign being raised by an ex-Beatle. The young woman in the car alongside him was May Pang, his and Yoko's ex-personal assistant. Lennon had recently begun a relationship with her, one that was to last 18 months. When it was over, he would return to Yoko. May Pang later married David Bowie's producer, Tony Visconti. Another Big Apple interview was, or should have been, with John McLaughlin. He was the austere 100-mile-an-hour jazz rock guitarist and co-founder of the Mahavishnu Orchestra, whose brilliantly atmospheric Inner Mountain Flame album was a bone-chilling experience. Tracks like You Know, and especially The Dance of Maya are, to my mind, works of undanceable rock genius. McLaughlin's special talent is to set the various tonal and rhythmic elements in opposition to each other, so that, in straining for resolution, they produce some creepily tense moments. While Lennon cut down people who irritated him with brutal one-liners, McLaughlin, I discovered, was more the silent type. The group's tour manager, Anthony Barone, promised me an interview and a listen-in on the Mahavishnu Orchestra jamming if I sped over by cab right now. He meant to a boiler room of a rehearsal studio called Baggies in the southwest corner of Manhattan. When I got there, Barone was making phone calls from an office that was filled with assorted hip-looking types, including one who stretched lazily on a tabletop. Joints were passed around on a car aerial and everyone was smiling. Mahavishnu drummer Billy Cobham leant against a friend's shoulder, sipped a Coke, then slid into the back room where some of the city's heaviest musicians were in the middle of a workout. Cobham jogged a few steps like a heavyweight between rounds and sat behind his kit. Facing him on chairs were the hungry figures of John McLaughlin and Carlos Santana, and on keyboards, the well-fed frame of Larry Young in straw sun hat and power robes. Completing the lineup on bass was the lank, spike-haired Doug Roach, slouching on a stool, gigolo glasses hanging halfway down his nose. While only McLaughlin and Cobham were recognisably Mahavishnu players, these were among the best instrumentalists to be found anywhere. They were also so very self-consciously cool. Both McLaughlin and Santana were dressed all in white, signalling their allegiance to Sri Shimnoi, an Indian spiritual leader who taught meditation in the West after moving to New York City in 1964. I made a note at the time about the jam session. It reads, "They roll into what sounds like a variation on Birds of Fire, with Roach forcing the way with a low register slow-moving bass line. McLaughlin and Santana hold steady, McLaughlin flicking out chords and Santana hanging on to a single feline note. The band eventually eases down. Santana rounds off with a final flurry, and the amps fall silent. Cobham and Santana packed their shoulder bags and took off, and Roach wandered through to the office. McLaughlin didn't want to talk after all. It was the loosest turn-off imaginable. But he didn't want to know. Cool? Not very. "Come back at 6 tomorrow," he said, "and we'll talk then." 6 o'clock one day later, McLaughlin is leaving Baggies with Carlos Santana and a couple of Santana's South American friends. They're off to a very grand Fifth Avenue hotel for a shower and change, and then on to Sri Shinmoy night at Hunter College, at which the two musicians plan a short acoustic set. "Can you come back tomorrow?" McLaughlin asks diffidently. "Does this go on day after day?" I thought. "Is this the way the remainder of my life plays out? This is not cool." Then Carlos saved the day. "Come on back to the hotel," he said, "and we can talk between showers, huh?" And that's what happened. At least I got to speak to Carlos, or, to give him his spiritual name, Dava Deep. It means lamp of the world. Carlos, Dava Deep, summarized the benefits of being a Shinmoy follower like this. "The guru helps me help God and to help people get away from destruction, illusion, and frustration. Eventually, these things imprison people and cut them off from joy and being at one with God. And on a personal level, it has made it possible for my soul to come forward. By me surrendering my ignorance to him, he gives me light. He gives me a higher step to a higher consciousness. Now I'm more relaxed than ever." And he did seem relaxed. I wouldn't say the same of McLaughlin, but perhaps it was just one, make that two, of those days for him. His spiritual name was the same as his band's, Mahavishnu, and the meaning of the term is the super soul of all living beings, Jivitmas in all material universes. That's quite something to be. Mahavishnu wandered into the bedroom looking clean in a fresh white suit. He'd had his shower, and so had Santana's South American friend, Eduardo. So now it was time for Dava's dip, the super soul of all living beings. Meanwhile, was still not talking to me. And I had no idea why.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
On being a music journalist, the message. I confessed earlier my spectacularly inaccurate prophecy made in 1975 about where the career of Bruce Springsteen was going. This was a time when the industry's hype machine was running at full stretch. Within 6 months, I wrote, he would be either musically wiped out or, more likely, just another average regarded also-ran. In 2013, some 38 years later, I was asked by a Chicago publisher for permission to include my quote and the long feature it came from in a book of interviews, speeches, and encounters with the great man. Sure, why not? As a critic, you dish it out, you should be able to take it too. It was overwhelmingly a book of praises, with my refusenik piece, as far as I could tell, swimming lonely against the tide. But I certainly don't retreat from its main point. Quite the opposite. Called Bruce Springsteen and the Wall of Faith, and published in the November 15, 1975 issue of NME, it was actually a study of an extreme case of music industry hype. The noise and manoeuvres accompanying the public launching of Brand Springsteen were, from my own experience, unprecedented. That he survived is a mark of his resilience and his work ethic. It began for me when I joined maybe a dozen print and broadcast journalists being flown out to Hollywood to witness a series of Springsteen performance at the Little Roxy venue in Hollywood. We would also interview the man. You'll get a sense of how much CBS had staked on this promotional pageant when I tell you who turned up for the series of shows between October 16 and 19. They included Jack Nicholson, G. Harrison, Jackson Brown, Neil Diamond, Jackie DeShannon, backstage introduction, Carol King, backstage introduction, Joni Mitchell, left early, Cher and Greg Allman, twice, Tom Waits, hitched from his own gig 90 miles away, Richard Carpenter of the Carpenters, DJ Wolfman Jack, and Warren Beatty. Our job was simple, capture and describe the moment, the music and the man. We'd been flown 7,000 miles from the UK to do it. The problem was Bruce's manager, Mike Appel. He ran us to the wire. We were getting closer and closer to flying home time, and the promised interviews weren't happening. Appel was a curiosity, even among the hard-bitten ranks of rock and roll managers. Looking again at some of the bellicose nonsense coming from him in 1975, you can see it derives from his conviction that this property he controlled and believed in, Springsteen, that is, gave him commanding firepower over all that might stand in his way. Record business types, for instance. John Hammond, the legendary Columbia producer and talent scout who signed Springsteen, said that Appel was as offensive as any man I've ever met. The media also had to learn there were new rules on matters relating to how much and what kind of coverage Springsteen was to get. However mighty the magazine or newspaper, Appel told me, he applied the same it's a cover or nothing approach. I say to you, I'm giving you the most coveted thing I can give you. I'm giving you an interview with Bruce Springsteen. There's nothing more I can give you. Bruce Springsteen is the greatest artist in the world today. That's all. It was a sentiment he emphasized by attacking the palm of his left hand with his right fist. His response to complaints about the amount and screechy nature of the hype was even more straightforward. I say, listen, fellows of the press, your vanities may have been up, your ego might have been up, but let's stop the bullshit. The kid's really good. He's really different. If you've any kind of talent, you'll recognize him. If you don't, you'll be run over. It's like a steamroller. We'll win in the end. You've got no chance against us. You've got no chance because we're right. We're good. Appel used to write commercial jingles. He was also in the Marine Reserves. Ideal qualifications for managing a hot property. When I spoke to Springsteen about the way Appel was carrying on, he reacted as though it was a fresh and stinging discovery. It's like you can't lay an attitude on people. It's like bullshit. It's like a jive thing. It's a terrible thing. You can't come on like you're some big deal, you know? I ain't into coming on like that because it's a basic thing that's going on. It's a simple thing. It's a band, you know. It's a rock and roll band, and you just sing and write songs. American rock critic John Landau, who co-produced Springsteen's Born to Run album, also played a central role in launching brand Springsteen. His language had just been as fevered as Appel's in the rock area. Springsteen's not only a great artist, but also happens to be able to do more things better than anyone else I've ever seen. Also, he's the best performer in the history of rock and roll, with a possible exception of Elvis Presley, whom Landau nominated mainly for sentimental reasons. Peter Philbin, Columbia's New York-based international press officer, was another believer who could talk up Springsteen with fireball rhetoric. In the ranks of Springsteen's band, meanwhile, there was an awestruck, almost religious regard for the boss. Clarence Clemens, the 33-year-old sax man, told me, "Bruce is the greatest person I've ever met. He's the strongest person I've ever met. When I first met him, it was like in the Bible, where this guy met this guy, and he'd say, 'Lay down your things and follow me.' And that's exactly the way I felt, man. But I didn't. And I punish myself. And I guess God punishes me, because I got in this car accident and I nearly got killed and shit. Anyway, he came back from California, where he'd been visiting his parents. And we got together, and here we are." Could the steamroller be stopped? Time and Newsweek magazine both got flattened. They were bullied and maneuvered into breaking with long tradition and running cover features on Springsteen in the same week. The stories themselves, interestingly, were tepid and fairly neutral. Newsweek's carried the faint suggestion that Springsteen might, after all, be a creature of hype. By the week's end at the Roxy, Springsteen was being exalted to a degree that was more Christian revivalist than Hollywood excess. The previous use of the site was as a strip club. By now, even the president of the Columbia Record Group was up on his chair, stirred perhaps by the avalanche of dollars that was mounting in his imagination. When I spoke to Springsteen about these matters, about the inordinate hype, comparisons with Dylan and James Dean, and Appel's control freakery, he retreated to a state of grunting inarticulacy. He didn't want it to be like this. He just wanted his music. Nah, it's like, if anything, you know, all I do, like, I write down my impressions of stuff. Like, and what I see, you know. It's like, but if you're looking for something to look to, if you're into the band, it's like, I don't know. I can't really see myself like that. He looked the picture of innocence. But were these negative distractions all down to Appel's crass and bullying manner? In fact, more than one commentator had seen Appel as the man who did much to shape Springsteen's early poet-hobo image, and then helped break him into the big time. Did Appel not serve a purpose for a while, after which he became a disposable embarrassment? I can't know. Of Springsteen's future, I offered the opinion back in 1975 that he was no more than a frontman for another good rock and roll band, composer of R&B slanted material that tipped a little in advance of the mean average. The supposed profoundly cerebral inclinations were also misleading, because Springsteen had neither the originality nor the intentions, political or otherwise, of a Dylan, which left him with a sack full of punk loner mannerisms, of which he was already tiring. Appel, Lando and Philbin thought they had to protect and talk up their man, otherwise he died, whereas Springsteen said he needed protecting from their excesses. "I used to feel I was always in control," he told me, "but now I'm not so sure." By the time of the November 1975 Springsteen episode, I was no longer dizzyingly infatuated by the music scene. My early mistake had been to imagine, or let's say half-imagine, that the composer and performer of a sublime piece of music was necessarily as impressive as the work he or she created. Music such as McLaughlin's Dance of Maya was a wonderfully creepy, discordant creation that took you planet-hopping before leading you down a sweetly sane landing. I doubt that McLaughlin himself, separated from his music, could be so stirring and inspiring. And then there were the culture gods, David Bowie and Eric Clapton, who, when apparently lashed by intoxicants, went public with statements that respectively gloried in anti-black bigotry and called for the imposition of a fascist dictatorship because Western liberalism was so awfully tedious and was getting us nowhere. Clapton was performing in Birmingham on the 5th of August 1976 when he suddenly launched into a drunken, racist diatribe in which he heaped praise on that cultured bigot, Tory MP Enoch Powell. Clapton reportedly told the audience, and bear in mind that his entire musical oeuvre was an appropriation of black American blues, "Vote for Enoch Powell. Enoch's our man. I think Enoch's right. I think we should send them all back. Stop Britain from becoming a black colony. Get the wogs out. Get the coons out. Keep Britain white. I used to be into dope, now I'm into racism. It's much heavier, man. Fucking wogs. Man, fucking Saudis taking over London. Bastard wogs. Vote for Enoch, he's our man. He's on our side, he'll look after us." This ode to English xenophobia was, say witnesses, lengthy, insistent, bitter, and without a hint of satire or game-playing. I've seen a filmed interview shot a while later in which he once more laments a disappearing white Britain, this time without the foul epithets. 3 months earlier, in May 1976, fans and photographers crowded London's Victoria Station, hoping for a glimpse of David Bowie, who was returning to the capital on the Orient Express. His chauffeur was on hand, driving his newly acquired black convertible Mercedes. Bowie finally moved from the train to the car, stood up and raised an arm, in a way that looked to many like a Nazi salute. It was denied, of course. A Nazi salute? No way. But then came publication of the September 1976 issue of Playboy magazine, in which writer Cameron Crowe, later a major Hollywood director, interviewed a high-flying Bowie. "You've often said that you believe very strongly in fascism, yet you also claim you'll one day run for Prime Minister of England. More media manipulation?" Christ, everything is a media manipulation. "I'd love to enter politics. I will one day. I'd adore to be Prime Minister. And yes, I believe very strongly in fascism. The only way we can speed up the sort of liberalism that's hanging foul in the air at the moment is to speed up the progress of a right-wing, totally dictatorial tyranny and get it over as fast as possible. People have always responded with greater efficiency under a regimental leadership. A liberal wastes time saying, 'Well, now, what ideas have you got? Show them what to do, for God's sake. If you don't, nothing will get done.' I can't stand people just hanging about. Television is the most successful fascist. Needless to say, rock stars are fascists too. Adolf Hitler was one of the first rock stars." How so? Think about it. Look at some of his films and see how he moved. I think he was quite as good as Mick Jagger. It's astounding. And boy, when he hit that stage, he worked an audience. Good God, he was no politician. He was a media artist himself. He used politics and theatrics and created this thing that governed and controlled the show for those 12 years. The world would never see his like. He staged a country. Really, I would like to be Prime Minister, but I think I'd have to set up my own country first. I don't want to be Prime Minister of the old country. I'd have to create the state that I wish to live in first. I dream of one day buying companies and television stations, owning and controlling them. This wasn't the real Bowie speaking, his friends explained. The 1976 Playboy interview was the product of cocaine psychosis. His mother Peggy also had a fleeting attraction to fascism, it has been reported, but this was even less substantial in its motivation. It was the black shirts, those sleek and slimming namesakes, that were the magnet. If this is an accurate reading of Peggy, then insubstantiality is something mother and son have in common. Musically, Bowie was rippling with talent. He was a great sonic artist. But his lyrics were thin, without resonant meaning, without human insight. Like his stage shows, there was spectacle and bright colours, but this was diversionary. I don't believe he knew how to go beyond the surface aesthetic. The I Am a Fascist Playboy interview perfectly encapsulates my point. For Bowie, fascism is a performance. It is a composite. In his view of finely wrought dramatic gestures, with Hitler the master at working an audience. But fascism is more than a clever stage show. Beyond the thespian histrionics, people suffer and perish, cities burn, children starve to death. Could Bowie see that far, feel that far? How much of it matters to the music? I would say that it matters when you feel that it matters. Bowie's flirtation with fascism doesn't make Hunky Dory less of an album, but it means I won't be inclined to close my eyes and swim along with it. The same holds for Clapton's music. But perhaps this new ambivalence I was feeling for the music that shaped my generation wasn't such a bad thing. If some of that music came from cracked vessels, that makes it all the more remarkable. The average white band, the Scottish soul funk outfit, who didn't even have a name when I first wrote glowingly about them, they too found more drama than they wanted in a small but influential nightclub on Sunset Strip called the Troubadour. During September 1974, they were booked for a week-long residency. I was living in LA at the time and attended all but one of those remarkable gigs, most of them with a friend called Bud Scoper, who wrote for Rolling Stone magazine. As their reputation grew, so did their starry following. Elton John, Martha Reeves, and Cher were among the names that joined them on stage for their final encore. The next morning, I received a phone call to say Robbie McIntosh, the AWB's remarkable drummer, was dead, killed by what were believed to be impure drugs he'd been given at a party. Robbie had fallen into a coma and never recovered. The band did manage to pick themselves up. They hit the number one single and album slot 6 months later and continue making quality music to this day. They even have two or three of the original lineup. Sometime after Robbie's death, maybe a year, I ran into the band's first manager, Robin Turner. We'd always got on and I was pleased to see him in the city, Los Angeles, in which I quite often felt a long way from home. He'd been invited to a party in the desert. Did I want to come? Elvis was going to be there. That's Presley, not Costello. A picture came into my mind of what Elvis was in the early years and what he had become while playing the slot machine venues in Vegas since 1969. From proud, sleek and spirited to a sickly self-parodist in a white jumpsuit. I was already feeling dispirited about the music scene and looking for a way out. Was a party in the desert, which I took to mean Las Vegas or maybe Palm Springs, likely to lift my spirits? I said thank you, but no. Then, as we went off in opposite directions, I turned to look at him to make sure the conversation had been real rather than voices in my head. and I thought, did I just say no thank you to a party with Elvis? As a rock journalist for NME and before that with Disc, I had enjoyed a front row seat for key cultural moments through much of the 1970s. When not roughing it so as to be there, e.g. a shivering storm lash Lincoln Festival, I had been housed in good hotels, flown thousands of miles to witness the latest sensation, and fed Jeroboams of champagne. I made small talk over coffee with Leonard Cohen, discussed crowd dynamics with Ozzy Osbourne, and played in goal behind striker John Cleese for a Monty Python five-a-side football game. Yet none of it made as big a mark on me as one little bird who flew into the lobby of an office block I was working in as a 16-year-old. She flew in and didn't know how to get out. Seeing the sky through a glass panel above the entrance, she repeatedly flew at it, trying to break through to freedom. Inches below the panel was the open door, but in her terror and confusion, it was invisible to her. I recall someone going for a ladder as the bird lay concussed on the ledge beneath the glass. That incident is still not resolved in my mind. I can't see the return of someone with a ladder, a rescue taking place, then cheering as the bewildered bird is brought down. Did I even wait in the lobby to see how it ended? I would probably have been too worried about my strict timekeeping boss. From my current vantage point, I see all the obvious life lessons that can be ground out from such an incident. Think, look around you before you go dashing at a plate glass window. For me, it's more simple. A small bird was in desperate trouble and I felt for her. I wanted to help, but I'm not sure I did help her for fear of upsetting authority and, if I'm honest, for fear of making a fool of myself. The little bird flew into my mind as I thought about how I had turned down Elvis. Maybe it was she who whispered in my ear that what was to follow my years with the Stars would be incomparably richer and more exciting. But that also ahead of me was some hard learning.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
First Rights. I was a filing clerk and fetcher of teas and sandwiches in the office of the trade newspaper Drapery and Fashion Weekly at the time of the trapped bird incident. I had joined the title, DFW to those in the know, in May 1962, 5 months before the Cuban Missile Crisis. The clock-watching boss, who I didn't want to disappoint, was the DFW's fastidious editor, Andrew Ross. There was no filing system before I started filling metal cabinet drawers with articles about company takeovers, quirky fabric designers, and other dull stuff that was useful to the editorial team. Outside, in the wider world, Europe's imperial holdings were crumbling and catching fire, and communism and capitalism were pawing the ground and eyeballing each other. At DFW, I continued holding the line. My ambition was audacious, but the alternative was permanent workplace drudgery. My ambition was to jump the bar from office boy to journalist, even though it was a job for which I was uniquely unqualified. I was 15 years old, had left school 10 months earlier without having sat any exams, and I had only just read my first book, a James Bond spy thriller. Yet I held tight to my golden ambition. Journalism, of itself, was a noble pursuit when done honestly. Moreover, journalists are writers, and writers write books. To have a book published with my name on it would be a glorious moment of fulfillment. It will be my perfect riposte to that insistent voice, my own, that told me I was a thing of no consequence, spilling randomly through the world until that moment when I met my random dead end. This formulation was nothing personal to me. It's how I saw everyone's mortal journey. The alternative, I then believed, was submission to a vengeful, fire-breathing God who was everywhere and saw everything. But these were weighty abstractions. There was ground to make up if I was to convince Andrew Ross to give me a writing job. After more than 18 months of diligent attention to my filing duties and of sprinting to the cafe on the corner for cheese and pickle sandwiches, I'd seemingly made no impression on him. It was my mother who, sharing my frustration, wrote to Ross without telling me, beseeching him to give me a break. Thankfully, I never saw what she wrote, but she did show me his reply. Andrew needs to improve his diction if he's to be considered as a serious prospect for advancement. The use of terms such as ain't and nothink do not fit with the role. I'm sorry to disappoint you. Ross was adored by the DFW women because of his unshowy confidence and his handsome, refined facial features that were crowned with prematurely greying hair. I was also told that his withered right hand added to his appeal since it signalled vulnerability. But now, here was a man from Poland, still with traces of a European accent, shutting down my prospects because of a few ain'ts and nothings. Worse still, when I'd thought objectively about the situation, I saw that he had a point. This was 1963, a time encrusted with even thicker layers of class snobbery than our own. If my self-improvement project was to mean anything, I would have to go with his Emery Higgins remedy and ditch everything about the way I spoke that revealed a lack of breeding and education. I hate the thought now of having been drawn into playing such a crappy, snobbish game, but play I did. In spare moments, I flipped pages of a dictionary and rehearsed the meaning of new words. I read more and better books. I had read my very first Dr. No while operating an old-fashioned plug-in switchboard for a City of London Greek shipping company. I remember dissolving blissfully into the world of 007 as I turned the pages. I read more James Bond than something similar from Len Deighton. By the time I was with Drapery and Fashion Weekly, I had graduated to John le Carré and his smiley spy novels. I next leapt skywards to take on the non-fiction worlds in Collision by Emmanuel Velikovsky. This was several hundred times more exciting than Bond and Le Carré. It described celestial turmoil some 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Planets and comets were thrown into lethal trajectories, and a comet-like object passed so close to Earth, our home planet was thrown off its orbit and axis. The result was floods, fires, plagues, and other immense happenings that can be found in the myths of ancient cultures. One such happening, I recall Velikovsky including, was the miraculous painting of the Red Sea for Moses and the fleeing Israelites. Then it occurred to me that if I wanted to be a writer, I should start writing. Taking Le Carré and Fleming as my lead, I concocted a drama involving murders in a Kensington fish restaurant. I followed up with an equally daft tale of sandwich shop killings that turned out not to be murders at all, but a dream had by the main protagonist. My break came when I travelled a couple of floors in the lift with a group editorial director, Stanley Mason. In response to his routine inquiry about my progress, I told him about my fish restaurant killings, and he responded, "Drop it off with my secretary, I'll take a look." There were 6 typed pages of it. I typed them all out again that night, minus the obvious errors, so as to impress Stanley Mason. Being nearly 17 at the time, I was the usual muddle of teenage uncertainties and contrariness. I was both guileless and aware. I was shy and thought little of myself, except for those times when I smacked up against an obvious injustice and saw no way out but to fight my corner. That was my experience when, Just months after leaving school and before joining Drapery and Fashion Weekly, I was taken on as a junior assistant with Malabar, the hairdressers, at its branch in Regent Street. Hairdressing was one of those culturally okay jobs for working-class Jewish kids, along with taxi driving and most things in the clothing trade. A junior's role was to wash clients' hair and, like a nurse to a surgeon, hand up pins, clips and rollers to a qualified cutter. Regent Street was a prestige branch where the tips were good and the staff were expected to show a little panache, tell witty stories and listen to Madam's domestic dramas. But I was no crowd-pleasing extrovert and so was soon banished to the coiffeur's equivalent of the Siberian salt mines, Malabar's branch in Bounds Green, a dozen tube stops and several miles northwest of central London. Almost immediately, I was dragged into staff room grumbles and gossip. Somebody said that Malabar's pay levels were insultingly low and seemed designed to sap staff morale. I agreed. Within minutes of returning to sink number four, I was called to the management staff room, where the branch boss put his head inches from my own and said slyly, "I'm hearing that you're unhappy in your work." "Unhappy?" My cheeks flushed. "I'm happy," I insisted, whereupon he repeated what I'd said in the staff room about pay. "You are not forced to work in my shop," he said, "and there has been no complaints until you came here. Perhaps you are a troublemaker." "I'm not a troublemaker." "But I've heard you are a troublemaker. You look like a troublemaker. And you've got spies where you shouldn't have them," I said clumsily, but with intent. "Is that right?" "Yes, and your pay is too low." "Off you go then. That's what I'm doing." I strode rapidly from the shop, but my dramatic door slam elicited only chiming bells. A couple of minutes of angry walking later, I realised I'd left my coat and money in the staff room. I returned like a ghost to silence and left in the same spirit, having picked up what was mine. Stanley Mason seemed to have all the time in the world when I met him in his office to talk about the fish restaurant murders. He was comfortable to be with, and even when I giggled at his common sense observations, he knew it was because laughter is the honest response when the truth suddenly erupts in front of you. His desk was a large, heavy piece of dark wood furniture, softened with curves and rounded decorative carvings. His chair, by contrast, was the pared-down contemporary sort that swiveled and moved easily about on casters. For a man with a high-level responsibility for so many trade and consumer titles, his desktop was remarkably clean. As he turned the pages of my fish restaurant melodrama, he pointed at the places where my plotting fell apart and where I was more interested in trying to impress than push the story on. He pointed also at things he liked. Stanley Mason offered encouragement, criticism, and a generous amount of his time in half a dozen further such meetings. And while my early literary efforts were no doubt comically inept, he took them and me seriously. We didn't speak of it, but he knew I felt trapped in my filing role. He looked at me without sentiment and said, "Be outstanding. Don't wait for good things to happen. Work at it. Reach for it. Trust yourself." Everyone, when they're young, unless they are preternaturally self-possessed, needs a Stanley Mason. Did I thank Stanley properly? I sincerely hope I did. Years later, I tried, but failed to find him. Within 2 weeks of our first meeting, a story I wrote was published in Drapery and Fashion Weekly. Admittedly, it was only 3 sentences long and related to a drapery shop that was about to open in Mare Street, Hackney. I learnt of the imminent opening from a poster in the window. It was a modest bulletin of news, but I was now a published writer. It was probably 4 or 5 months later that a junior DFW reporting post became vacant. I applied and was appointed, though strictly on a trial basis. Andrew Ross wore a sorry face for a few weeks, but with help from the subs, I was delivering sound copy. When one of my reports about changes at the top of the Cooperative Wholesale Society made DFW's page one lead, I tried to maintain a sober and modest demeanour. But the newsroom, subs, reporters, design staff were backslapping me and insisting we celebrate down the pub. Then came the crash landing. My report of a speech given at a weekend conference for trainee department store managers was said to have misrepresented the speaker's words. He claimed he did not say, "Remember your goal. It is to get the pound in her purse into your till." Rather, he said, "Getting the customer's pound into your till has to be a secondary goal to providing a good service." The complainant was an important figure in the world of department stores, and though my admittedly untidy notes supported my version, he was given space for a clarification. Was I to be trusted after all? I imagine my newsroom colleagues saying to each other, "Tyler has no kind of training, you know, and he's still only 18. I was still the office boy to them. I spent so long, 2.5 years, fetching their sandwiches, pleasing them by remembering their individual milk and sugar preferences for hot drinks, that they would always see me as a junior. It was the main reason I accepted a job offer on a smaller monthly trade magazine called The Office, where there would be just the editor and me. But before that came an important growing up incident at Drapery and Fashion Weekly. It happened the morning the white supremacist Rhodesian government of Ian Smith made a unilateral declaration of independence. It wanted no more part of British rule. In fact, Rhodesia had governed itself since 1923, the year it was annexed by the United Kingdom. From the start, it was run by a white clique who could find no place for the 95% of the population that was non-white. But post-war Africa was a different place. Britain now refused to agree to formal separation unless Smith government accepted the principle of no independence before majority rule. Both sides dug in, and UDI was declared on November the 11th, 1965.
That was My Life as an Animal by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith. Produced by Tom Davidson and adapted for UK Health Radio by Monkey Nut Audiobooks. My Life as an Animal is available on Audible and audiobook sites. Be sure to tune in next time to hear more from this title. This audiobook is published by Monkey Nut Audiobooks in Hampshire, UK.